There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
On this episode, I'm very excited to be joined by an English footballing icon and a man who's inspired a generation of flair footballers. The one and only John Barnes. JB, thanks for joining us, mate. Absolute pleasure.
As always, mate. Anything for you, you know that.
You know. With our guests, we always start. Let's take you right back to the beginning. What was it like growing up in Jamaica for a young John Barnes? Talk me through that.
Well, my dad was a colonel in the Jamaican Army, so I grew up on the army base my whole life. And when you say it's an army base, it's like, I don't know, 100 acres and they've got a pool and they've got football pitches and there's no schools. But I had the free run of going to see my mates because it's very safe on the army base. Of course, Jamaica's not the safest place for an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old boy to be running around. But because I grew up there, I was playing football after 11 o'clock and my dad played football for Jamaica. He was a colonel in the army, but he played football, so I grew up playing football. So I remember being out. My mum's family started the first Jamaican government, so they're quite an elite political family. Not rich, but politically minded, so they're educated. They were light-skinned, middle-class Jamaicans, so I had a very privileged upbringing. Then, of course, you know, when we got the opportunity to come to England, my dad then got posted as military attaché to England. He went to Sandhurst in the 50s. I don't know anyone at Sandhurst, he's just an officer. So my dad went to Sandhurst with Andrew Parker Bowles, Camilla's husband. So when we came, as he came back as military attaché, Andrew Parker Bowles, every now and again, came to our house to dinner, because he remembered my dad. His wife wasn't with him, so we don't know where she was. But the future queen was obviously occupied somewhere else. But of course, then coming to England as a diplomat's son, we then, you know, lived in as much as, you know, my mates lived not far from you in Mornington Crescent and Camden Town, and went to school in Marylebone. Yeah. But we lived in Highgate, we lived in Hampstead, in Golders Green, we lived in Mayfair, we lived right by the Ritz. So I had a very privileged upbringing.
Obviously, we've joked about my connection is because we went to the same school, and you know. And, you know,
a few years later,
but like, you know, you think if you go on to play for England, you'd like to think you're the best player that's ever come out of your school. I'm not even the best player to come out of my school to wear number 11 for England on the left of midfield. That's such a coincidence.
Well, there you go. You listen, I've got a number one song as a rapper, and I'm the best rapper from my school, but Adam Ant went to my school. You know, the first girl I went to Marylebone before I went to Haverstock. Yeah. So Adam Ant, you know what I mean? How can I say I've got a number one Adam Ant with at the school? So there you go.
But listen, it's such an eclectic area. Like you said, because Haverstock, the school we went to, back when you would have gone in the 79, 80. So it would have been quite a rough school back then, Johnny.
Even though I was privileged upbringing in Jamaica when I came to England. But I'm playing football in Harton and Wilston and in Jamaica from a young age. So therefore, while that was my life as a schoolboy, not my family life, if you like, but I've been fighting and going around Harton and Wilston, you know, Somers Town. All my mates lived in the Hawcroft Estate. And they were my friends. I didn't have any friends in Golders Green, Highgate, Mayfair, anywhere I lived. They were not my friends. Yeah. That's where my family lived and that's where I lived. Yeah. But all of my mates went to, the school then became North Westminster, but it used to be Paddington and Rutherford and Sarah Siddons Girls School. And they were rough schools. And all my mates who played for Stowe Boys Club. So these were my friends. Yeah. So my family life and that life was completely different. Yeah. But as you say, it's an eclectic area because of course it's a mile from the West End. Mm. And it's a bit like if you go around, as you know, Islington and places like that. Yeah. And everyone's going, oh yes, I live in Islington, Hoxton. I said, you wouldn't have been there 30 years ago. You know what I mean? It was rough. Yeah. These are rough areas. Yeah. But geographically, because they were located close to the West End, it was eclectic. You had and it became gentrified, as you know. I mean, maybe you can, but I can't afford a place anywhere around there now.
Do you know, we're like, I'm going to go off piste a little bit here, because obviously you come from Jamaica was it late 70s, early 80s when Bob Marley, because he lived in the next road down to me in Chelsea, and I watched a documentary about him about how his music, the Jamaican reggae scene, comes.
Yeah. My mum and dad know Bob Marley. Well, my mum was a record producer, a television producer. She was always on the shows, and Bob Marley loved football. So my dad,
he was a colonel in the army.
So my dad played football. He's a colonel in the army, but of course, because he's a good footballer, there's no professional football. Then he managed the Jamaican national team, and the most famous Jamaican footballer was a player called Alan Cole. We call him Skill Cole, Rastafarian.
Yeah.
And he went to Brazil to play for Santos, and he then didn't make it, but he came back and said they wanted me to cut my dreadlocks, and I wouldn't. That's why, so Jamaicans love him. So he's the Jamaican hero.
Right.
So when my dad coached the Jamaican national team, and my dad is a disciplinarian in the army, but Bob Marley with his dreadlocks, Rastafarian, smoking ganja, marijuana in the dressing room, stuff like that, he had a little mate who he brought with him with a guitar, Bob Marley. This is before Bob Marley was famous, because Rastafarians know each other.
Yeah.
So my dad said he'd always be coming on this bike with this little fool with a guitar in the dressing rooms trying to smoke marijuana. And that was Bob Marley.
There's a big connection between Jamaica and England, especially in North London. I've got friends from Jamaica. So, I mean, was that a big change for you as a kid, John, coming over here and the sun and the relaxed sun and into London and that busy? Did you love it? Did you thrive off it? Or was it difficult?
Yeah. I landed January the 26th, 1976.
Yeah.
Heathrow.
Right.
Coming over Heathrow, which then became Chelsea's old training ground right by Heathrow.
Harlington.
Sunday morning. The plane's coming into land. You look over on a Sunday morning in January, what do I see? Young kids playing football. As it's coming to land, I see young kids my age, organised football, kit, and I just went, I'm home.
Heaven.
Heaven.
Your journey is so unique in the fact that you went and you're playing Sunday football for Sudbury, and you got picked up at 16, nearly 17, by Watford.
By Watford,
That seems so far out for these young kids now playing football that you would have been missed for that long, and then bang, it happened so quick. Talk to us about that.
That's what it was back then. I mean, now you've got academies, so no kid who's older than 9 or 10.
Yeah.
If you've got any time to be in an academy.
So this was proper Sunday league.
But before that, I went to Stowe Boys Club on the Harrow Road.
Right.
And at Stowe Boys Club, Paddington, all my mates were from Harlesden and Willesden.
Yeah.
Great team. We won the National Five-A-Side Championships in Bradford, first time I ever went up north. Lots of good players. We're winning 10 and 12 nil every single week.
Really?
But when I went to that team for the first time, I came there like 12, 13. The boys had been there since under 11, so they know each other, playing. Yeah. I've gone there from Jamaica. They're winning 8 and 9 and 10 nil all the time. No one wants to play defence.
Right.
So I played centre-back.
Yeah.
So for four years, between the ages of 12 and 16, I played centre-back for the team, 11-a-side. Never played anywhere else. I was never a centre-back. But you see, my dad's an army officer, and his thing is discipline, responsibility, respect, the responsibility to the team. And he says, if no one wants to play there, you're going to play there. So I was never a centre-back. But because no one else wanted to play there, I played there.
Yeah.
Yeah? For 4 years, nowhere else. The coach from Stowe Boys Club, then when we became 16, we couldn't play for Stowe Boys Club anymore, we're too old.
Yeah.
He now runs the team St. Joe's on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So he's going to take me, Derek Sylvester, a few of the better players, to his club. But he now knows that you're not going to come and play Sunday league football as a 16-year-old skinny kid from Jamaica. So he put me on the left wing, because he always knew I was an attacking player.
Yeah.
So I played left wing for St. Joseph's on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And one of the players who played for St. Joseph's also played on a Saturday for Sudbury Court.
Right.
So he said, come and play for Sudbury Court on a Saturday. For 3 months.
Yeah.
Taxi driver drove by, saw Sudbury Court playing, saw me, knew a scout at Watford, said, come on, look at this boy. Yeah. And at that time, my mum and dad had already become, it was a 4-year diplomatic posting.
Right.
So we knew we were going to go back to Jamaica. Right. So this is the last 6 months of me being in England. I'm just playing football. I'm going to got offered a scholarship to Howard University.
Right.
So I'm going to go get a football scholarship, go and play in Howard. 4 months before that happens, taxi driver sees me playing, come and train at Watford for a while.
Yeah.
2 months before my mum and dad go back, I'm going to Howard. Watford said, do you want to stay and play?
Did you?
So I signed for Watford.
So you go to Watford, you make your debut against Oldham in 1981.
Yeah.
I mean, how special was that? And did you Was your dad and mum, was they in the country at the time?
No, they got back.
So they didn't see your debut?
No, they never saw, because don't forget, as I said, the family are now going to go back. We just stayed to finish school. That's what I was at Haverstock.
So they're back now.
So my mum stayed because my dad had to go back. So my dad got recalled back to Jamaica.
Right,
he's a diplomat. He goes back to join the army as a colonel.
Yeah.
He goes back, but we can't go with him because we've got to finish school.
Right.
Because it's like he went back in the January, but we've got to wait till July.
Yeah.
School finishes. We then go back. So my dad's gone back.
Yeah.
Obviously, he thinks I'm coming back as well. So he goes back. We're just finishing school. All this happens in the March, April, May.
Yeah.
My mum, after we finish school in May, my mum and sisters go back. I'm not even going to Watford yet. I'm going to go. I've signed, but preseason doesn't start until June. So my mum and dad have gone back. I've not even gone to Watford for preseason yet because I've just signed as a first-year pro. I'm living for a month with my mum's mate until they're going to Diggs in Watford. So I'm going to Diggs at Watford in the July.
Yeah.
But as I said, even when we lived in Mayfair, my dad's thing was you train hard.
Yeah.
So I would run around Regent's Park. I'd run around up Primrose Hill.
Yeah.
Up and down, you know, that hill up there.
I know,
I'd sprint up and down that hill and run around Hyde Park. Because my dad's thing was, you have to be prepared in anything you do. Just to give an example, when I was 11, in Jamaica, I used to swim. My sister swam for Jamaica, you used to swim, and you had to swim every day, training in the national pool. But I'd stop off to play football. And my dad said, if you're not going to go to training every day to be disciplined, stop swimming. So I gave up swimming at 11. So my preparation was always about, yes, you have talent, but it has to be about your mind, your commitment to the team, your responsibility on playing centre-back, and your work and your hard work. So when I then went to Watford, I was going to be 17 in November. Mm. Then I'm 17. And you have apprentices who were there from their 15. Mm. So I was an apprentice, assigned as a first-year pro. And of course, the apprentices who then became first-year pros were like, well, we've been here for 2 years. Who's this young Barnes coming in here, blah, blah, blah. But because of my dad's discipline in me since I was born, I then, at 17, as soon as I went to Watford, Graham Taylor was like, okay, you're signed a first-year pro. And he's looking at my, in the running, in the weights, going to a lot of weights and stuff like that. Yeah. And I was so disciplined. He then involved me in the first team. I played one reserve game. The first reserve game, and this is why football was great back then. The reserves played on a Saturday at home in the stadium at 3 o'clock when football was played. Saturday, 3 o'clock, the reserves played in the stadium if the first team were away.
You're right, okay.
And the first game of the season, Watford played Newcastle. First reserve game of the season on the same day, we're playing at home against Swindon. 3 o'clock, I'm playing. I score after about 30 seconds against Swindon. That's my first and only reserve game.
Right.
So we played against Swindon. Watford played against Newcastle away. Luther gets sent off against Newcastle. So the next game is Oldham at home. The second game of the season. I've had one reserve game. No youth team games. Never played a youth team. Against Oldham, what happens when you get sent off back then is you just miss the next game. So he puts me on the bench for the first team.
Right.
He puts me on the bench for the first team. So I'm on the bench. Second game of the season. I've only had one game in professional football, the reserves the week before. On the bench against Oldham, I got off for 13 minutes.
Yeah.
He put me on for the last 13 minutes. That was it. I must have done all right. I don't think anything particular. I didn't score. The last 13 minutes, you're not really going to do much. The third game of the season, Luther is now going to come back into the team. I expect to go back to the reserves. Chelsea away.
Yeah.
Third game of the season. He doesn't put me on the bench. He puts me in the team.
Wow.
For Chelsea away, third game of the season. This is my second game for Watford. Played against Chelsea, we won 3-1, and I never left the team after Never left the first team after that.
Yeah. Graham Taylor was the manager. Was he a discipline? He must have been like your dad, disciplinarian.
I can't speak highly enough of Graham Taylor. I'm going to tell you a story about Graham Taylor now, which is an incredible story, which I only found out probably about a year ago, which is an incredible story because, of course, you're now talking about, and I'm going off piece there, but I have to mention Graham Taylor.
Oh,
he got a lot of stick, didn't he?
Yeah,
he got a lot of stick about certain bits
really
and pieces.
Dreadful.
And not only in terms of that, because there's a player who then talked about Graham Taylor talking about black players and playing blah, blah, blah. I did a thing with Luther about a year ago, and Luther said, and Luther only found out probably 6 months before that. Now we're talking about this is 2021. And he said, and we didn't even remember it, but somebody said this to Luther. We're playing against Oldham in 1982. And don't forget, when you're talking about Black Lives Matter, racism in football, back then in 1979, 80, 81, that's not even a conversation.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You know what's
going
on. Bananas squaring the crowd. No one even talked about that.
Mm.
But in 1982, we played against Oldham. Halftime comes, we come in, Graham Taylor's not there. Now, even at the time, I didn't notice anything about it because Stammen is the coach, took the team talk.
Yeah, yeah.
2 minutes before we came out, Graham came back, came to the dressing room and going, right, lads, off you go, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
We didn't even think anything of it. Never knew anything about it. But a year ago, Luther said, do you remember? I said, no, he didn't even remember. But he said, this is what happened. Roger Palmer, black player, played for Oldham.
Yeah.
Graham Taylor's on the side of the pitch, obviously, the game's going on. And Graham Taylor heard two or three people racially abusing Roger Palmer. No one heard it. And back then, if you heard it, it was a big deal because it just went on anyway. Yeah. No one heard. Graham Taylor never said a word to us, never said a word to anyone. Obviously, we went in. Sam Ellis took the team talk. We went back out. Didn't know what happened. Luther told me a year ago. He said, what happened was, Graham Taylor, when we went in at halftime, and not a player knew, no one knew, Graham Taylor went up into the stand and got the PA system from the microphone, you know, the PA man who announces.
Yeah.
He walked into the middle of the pitch. This is halftime. And he says, you've got John Barnes and Luther Blissett here. He said, if I hear anybody, any racist abuse towards Graham, towards Roger Palmer in the second half, you will never come to this stadium again.
Wow.
Whoever that is.
Wow.
Put the mic down. Came in. Come on, lads. Out you go. Of course, the press, no one made a big deal of that because back then there was no conversation.
Yeah.
This was 1982. That's what Graham Taylor was doing.
That's
and incredible. He doesn't tell anyone. He doesn't say, oh, I did this. And Graham Taylor said, no, say no to racism.
Yeah.
But he just went on the pitch, said that, came back in, just said, right, lads, off you go, go. And we went on one. Never said a word to anyone. He was a great man.
What a man. I mean, I didn't, obviously, it was before my time, Graham Taylor, but some of the stick he got from the media and the England fans was dreadful.
Yeah.
And the documentary he had, I watched it. But do you know what I got from him? Exactly what you said. I just got, that's a good human being, regardless of what I think about the way he played football.
Yeah, 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 absolutely,
But he looked like
he was incredible. And I'll tell you why, because you know what? When you talk about somebody who loves Winston Churchill and loves England and loves Britain,
yeah,
and he wants England to do well, and he believes that everybody should be on England's side. So his thing was, we all support England.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as you would know, not so much these days, but as a young player growing up, you know a lot of these pressmen want England to lose in the old days because of bad news sells, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Graham Taylor's thing was, listen, and with me, and he was a bit naive in that, he's very experienced, but I remember when he managed Watford, everybody loved Watford, because we like the underdog. We finished second in the league to Liverpool, we're beating Arsenal, we're beating Tottenham, so we love you. But when you play for England, it's different.
Yeah.
So when they played with me, they loved me, I'm playing for Watford and I'm playing well, Barnes is great. Then when I played for England, they gave me a bit of stick.
Right.
And it was like messing with me, I'm 18, 19, and Graham Taylor come to me and he said, listen, you know when the press, when they play football, they say you're brilliant and you're fantastic, you're the best in the world. He said, do you believe them? He said, if you believe them, when you play for England and they say you're crap, you've got to believe that as well. So he said, don't believe what they say about you when you play well and they say how great you are. You please me, you please the fans, you please, you know what you have to do. But when he managed Watford, everybody loved him.
Yeah.
Then when he went to England, he didn't think that they'll turn against him because he said, I'm now with England, this is my dream job. Everybody wants me to do well because the press, everybody wants it to do well, the fans are behind us. But as you know, it doesn't work that way. I mean, now it's a bit different, but even in your day with Glenn and whoever went through, if the press are after you, if they don't like you. So Graham was a bit naive in thinking, what I have to do is just open myself to the press and let them know what I'm trying to do. And of course, depending how things are edited, you're going to look like an idiot at times.
Yeah.
And I suppose when he did that show and that thing that you saw, they were very unkind the way it was edited and the way he came across, but he's not like that at all.
No, no. He was understandable in the sort of 90s to be naive around the media, do you know? Because
absolutely, but he's an experienced manager.
Yeah.
But even for someone like him, because his thing was that we're English, everybody wants England to do well.
Yeah.
And he just expected everybody to be like him in terms of their authenticity in wanting to be successful.
Mm.
But as you know, and that we had a fractious relationship with the press at times.
Yeah.
And Gazza went through that.
Yeah, yeah,
we love him, we love him, we love him. And Gazza thought they love me, and then all of a sudden they'll be Canaan in the next week. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and Graham Taylor was a bit naive in thinking that the press would be on my side even if I hold myself up to them and do anything. As we've seen with, I mean, Brendan Rodgers did the one, and Mikel Arteta's now done one. So depending on how it comes across, it can be a bit disingenuous in terms of the way they come across.
So with England, I remember watching you play for England. For people of the younger generation, you were the Thierry Henry of the time, like there was not a player like you, in my opinion, without wishing to embarrass you, but you was unbelievable. But when you played for England, I remember going to a game at Wembley, because I used to jump on the train at Kentish Town, get up to there.
You're going
to
say bunk on the train, didn't you? You're going to say bunk on, didn't you?
I was going to, but you know.
I used to jump on the train and pay my money.
Pay the full fare on the train. But I used to go to the game with my friends and watch the game, and you was getting booed. And I was looking around and I was like, how can we boo John Barnes? Like, even my mind, I'm like, he's our best player. And you scored a free kick in the game.
Against Holland, too old.
Was it Holland? Okay.
Yeah.
So my mind isn't playing tricks on me.
Yeah, it was too old, no.
But what do you think that was, John? Like,
well, first of all, it started the game before.
Right,
San Marino. Now, we played San Marino. We beat them 6-0. But on the Sunday, in the News of the World, Jimmy Greaves had done a piece about loyalty to England.
Right.
And what I used to say is, you know, when West Indies play England at cricket, I'm from Jamaica, and you would Brown Robson people, we're going to beat them. So, of course, that was the only thing. John Barnes, you know, wants West Indies to beat England at cricket. And you know, he's not, he wasn't born in England, so he's not, you know, necessarily loyal to England. So then when the game started against San Marino, that's that game that, you remember, they scored in the first 10 seconds. Yeah, so we go 1-0 down.
Yeah.
They should be doing Piercy flipping back pass, not me. But anyway, so they go 1-0 down. Now obviously we're going to come back and win, but we go 1-0 down. So for the first 10 minutes, it's like, oh, flipping hell. And news of the world story, John Barnes not committed, so they started to boo me. 1-0, 1-0, 2-1, 3-1, 4-1, 5-1, we won 6-1, but they continued to boo me throughout. And I thank Graham Taylor because it was horrible. It was horrible, and I must admit, I wanted to come off. It was that bad.
Right.
And Graham Taylor said to me at the end, once again, because I wasn't playing badly. We're winning 6-1, so I'm playing like anybody else. But every time I got the ball, they were booing me. Graham Taylor said, you know what? Even if you had played terribly, you weren't coming off.
Really?
He goes, I would not let them win. He said, if you had tripped over, scored 5 own goals, he goes, you were staying on the pitch. I was not going to take you off. And I thanked him for that. I must admit, at the time, I did want to come off because, I mean, it was horrible. But then I thought, when Graham Taylor said that to me, that I would never let them win. And they were booing you for nothing to do with football. So the next game against Holland started again. But I scored the free kick. And this is how football is. Because as soon as that free kick went in, everybody started to cheer, didn't they? But the thing about it is that you have to look at the way football was back then. I was at Liverpool at the time. The way Liverpool played suited me. Back then, English football was about aggression. It wasn't about skill and technique and stuff like that. It would have been hard for you to play back then. It was about the aggression, the Peter Reeds and the fighters. Sure. And the players who used to get a lot of stick, I mentioned three of us, Chris Waddle, and my favourite player of all time, who obviously may have managed you and may say something different. But when you talk about technique, Glenn Hoddle was an incredible footballer.
For sure.
Incredible. 50 caps, never played well a lot of times for England. If he was Italian, Spanish, German, Brazilian, he'd have 100 caps.
Yeah.
So all of the skillful players back then, every now and again, we'd play well. But because English football wasn't about that.
The system, the setup wasn't
the
there.
The setup was about the fighters. So every now and again, we would score a goal again and do things. But we weren't consistently going to do that because we would never think about dominating possession, keeping possession, moving left to right. When I played for Liverpool, when the ball came to me, most of the time, I laid off first time. Because I know I'd get it again and make a good decision of when to dribble, when to pass. With England, I felt every time I got it, I had to do something special because we didn't keep the ball a lot. So therefore, if I just pass it first time, I'm not going to get it again for 10 minutes. And what am I doing? So therefore, I was making bad decisions. Chris Waddle, Glenn Hoddle were all the same. So I kind of understood. And I suppose we're going through a similar thing now with Trent. Now, what happens is, if you want Trent Alexander, Bobby Robson used to say, play for England the way you play for Liverpool. I said, if England played the way Liverpool did, I would. So if England played like Liverpool, Trent would be there. But England don't play like Liverpool. So therefore, then talk about Trent in that way. If you want Trent Alexander to do what he does for Liverpool, you have to play like Liverpool.
Yeah.
But they don't, which is not right or wrong. It's just it is what it is. Yeah. And I felt the same thing with me with England.
Then players you listed, Waddle, Hoddle, yourself, you were my type of player. You were my favourite players.
I mean, after training, England, this is Brian Robson, great players. After training, sitting down just drinking a cup of water just on the side of the pitch, Glenn would go out and do stuff. And we just sit down and look at him and go, incredible footballer.
Yeah.
Juggling the ball, passing. He's just like, I mean, he wouldn't make it up here with his long hair and his little tight shorts coming from down south. Even though we don't have something that's coming up here.
Do you see, obviously, this Gareth Southgate's team, it's a coached differently, it's built differently. They're different human beings in the sense that, you know, their upbringing is different to what yours and mine as well. But there's still a little bit inside me that worries because James Maddison, for instance, he's going to be 26 maybe when this podcast goes, and he's only played once for England, and Jack Grealish is not one that's been trusted. Phil Foden on the younger scale of it, and maybe Mason not in that category, but do we still trust the flair players enough?
I think we do, because if you look at the way we play now, I think we do, but the problem we have is that they're left to their own devices. So if I think with Gareth, you look at Gareth's teams throughout, since the last World Cup, every time he's played, we've played well because the players have played well. I don't necessarily think he's done anything. It's like, rub their shoulders, go out and play, and they're great players. Now, the problem you have is if you want to go right to the top to win, and as much as, listen, when we got to the final, and even in Euros, I mean, we did really well. You look at the other group, in terms of the four teams in that group, had we been in that group, would you have done that? You know, Germany was the hardest team that we played. And it's an older German team, so we did well to go through to the final. The World Cup before, we'd beaten Sweden and somebody else who Columbia. We should beat. Then as soon as we came up against... But all you can do is beat who you have to beat, which is fine. But what happens is, if all of a sudden your Harry Kane's and your Foden's and these players aren't necessarily gelling in this particular game, that's when you need a manager to go, boom, boom, do something. Whereas I think Gareth just allows them to play, and because they're such good players that when everything is going well, they win matches. Yeah. But in the face of adversity, when things aren't going well, where you can see Klopp, you can see, I'll use Tuchel as an example, although he's not there anymore, you see Guardiola taking off Harry Kane and saying, put the centre forward up front or whatever, to do something, to affect it because the team's not going well. And that is why against Italy, when all of a sudden we went 1-0 up and it's like, well, what are we going to do now? And we sat back. So we've got very, very good players. Mm. And what very, very good players can do when things are going well is win football matches. Mm. But you can't then play that well, quarterfinal against Brazil, semi-final against Spain, yeah. final against Belgium, and just allow that to happen. Because you're going to go through a hard time.
Yeah,
and that is when you need a manager to shake something up.
Yeah.
And that's not Gareth's character, which is great for now because modern players don't like that, do they? Mm. But that's why you look at all the top managers. You look at Guardiola, you look at Klopp. As much as the players like them, they're scared of them.
Yeah.
And he makes decisions if he has to pull Salah off or whatever. So England will maximise their potential, which means that they should beat who they should beat, even though they haven't done well in this Nations League. But then when they get to the semi-finals, final, and they come up against a top team, yes, they can beat them if everything goes on and they're playing well. Yeah. But I just worry about them if they come up against adversity. How do you then come out of that?
Okay, that's an interesting point.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
BT Sport Pods. England, you know, it's promising, but you know, there's still somewhere to go before we're there. But your iconic moment, and I think for me growing up, what your goal in American Idol was, we've talked about this before, but you know, I can never get tired of it. And if anyone's young players are not watching this and they want to see a proper goal, go, get on and watch it. You said you didn't mean to score. You were looking for a pass.
Well, everybody does.
Yeah.
Everybody does. There's no way. I remember Ryan Giggs scoring against Arsenal, wasn't it?
Yeah, in the semi-final.
I think it was trying to waste time running to the corner. So what you do is, and there's nobody who gets the ball, no player, Maradona, Messi, nobody gets the ball on the halfway line with five players in front of them and think, I'm going to dribble around these five, either I'm going to lose the ball or I'm going to score. You look to pass and you can't see anyone to pass, so you keep going. Maradona's goal, you keep going. So I really looked for someone to pass and there was no one there, so I thought, well, I've got to keep going. What made the goal, and this is once again when you talk about faith, you know when things happen and you do things and it's like, unbelievable. And in your own mind, it goes, well, I never really meant that. Ronaldinho's goal against England, 2000. Yes. He never meant that. I'm not just going to go, I meant it. It's a free kick, but you do things, and you know you didn't really mean it, and people go, oh, what a great goal that was. So, as I've gone through, and I get to the eligible box, and he can watch it, I'm now going to shoot. Now, as I'm about to shoot, Tony Woodcock makes a run across. As I'm about to shoot, I've seen him in my eye line there, and therefore I can't shoot because I'll hit him.
Yeah.
So I've gone to shoot, and he's jumped up because someone thinking I'm going to shoot, I think I'm going to shoot. But if I'm, as I'm put my leg back to shoot, as I'm coming forward, he's in the way, so he jumps up, so I drag it inside. Only because I would have shot, but he was there. But as I've dragged it inside, obviously the defenders think I'm going to shoot as well, so they fall on the ground, and I've dragged inside, and I've gone flipping, and I'm right in front of the goal. So the point I'm making is that when you score a goal like that, and you're a dribbler, so you will understand this, and people go, when you dribble, you're meaning to do that.
Yeah.
If you score a free kick, you mean to score that free kick.
Yeah,
because you remember, you put the ball down, you think, I've got to bend the ball over the wall, into the top corner. So when you do it, because you consciously think about it, you remember doing it. When you score by dribbling, you're reacting to what the defender does. So you can't say, I'm going to come up to him, I'm going to go that way. Because if he stands there, you've got to do something else. So you don't think about what you're going to do. You just react to what he does and you do the opposite. So therefore, you don't consciously think about it. So when you go boom, 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 you don't mean to do that. You only do it because you're responding. So therefore, at the end of it, you don't remember what you actually did. So when you actually see it, so when I see the goal in Brazil, it's brilliant. It looks brilliant, but I do not remember doing any of it.
Like it's somebody else doing it.
It's like an out-of-body experience, you know? And it looks much better than it feels. Because when you score, either dribbling past players, All it feels like is, that's what it feels like. But when you see it on television, it's gliding and it's like, oh, I know what I'm doing. And it's all just like, and look at
sounds
me.
Sounds like samba music's playing.
You know what I mean? All I hear in my head is,
Barnsley, you're great times at Watford, but you're synonymous with your time at Liverpool. Kenny was the man who brought you in. I mean, they were the top side. Was it an easy decision to make to go there?
At first it wasn't, because in my naivety, I'm 17, I'm playing for Watford. We're in the first division, second to Liverpool, quarterfinals of the UEFA Cup, where we finished second, FA Cup. I'm staying at Watford my whole career. Love Watford, we're going to be a great team, we're going to win the league. But of course, you know, it's just a period of Watford's time where this was never going to continue. As you see, clubs come up and do that. But I didn't know that, I'm young. Graham Taylor, once again, the great man he was, he said to me, you've got to go.
Really?
Now imagine a manager now telling players they've got to leave rather than try and keep them. So Luther went to AC Milan, and all players he felt were his boys. He had a responsibility to their careers as well.
He said to me,
absolutely, and he's Watford's manager. He said, he said to me, you're going to Liverpool. Wow. And back then it wasn't a situation whereby you had an auction. Liverpool, Man United teams come in. Bron Robson, you know, Robbo, greatest player in England. He went to Man United when they were finishing fourth and fifth. Now you would have thought Liverpool had gone, oh, let's just get him instead of Man United, he's England's captain. But once a club came in for you going to that club, other clubs didn't say, we want you as well. So there was no other option. No one else came in for me. To be honest, a few years earlier, I've come from Jamaica and I'm 12, 13. I'm now 23. I've lived in London. Never went north of Birmingham. I wanted to stay down south. Because, of course, you know, you have a perception of what life's like up north. Flat caps and no electricity outside toilets. That's what you're told down south for you southerners. So I thought, well, Liverpool is a bit strange. They speak funny. It's a bit cold up there. Their people are a bit strange. So, you know, had Arsenal come in a couple of years earlier, I wanted to stay down south. But once Liverpool came in, and by that time I'd been up north and been around, so it wasn't a decision to be made. Graham Taylor said, you're going to Liverpool. So I was delighted to come. But the problem was, Liverpool came in for me in January. Graham Taylor said, Liverpool are coming for me, but you're not going. You're going to go at the end of the season. Because he didn't want me to leave mid-season. Yeah. You know, Watford were mid-table, you're going to stay to the end of the season. Mm. Liverpool knew I was coming at the end of the season. We knew, but the fans, the press didn't. Because you don't tell stuff in the press back then.
Yeah.
But because it had been made common knowledge that Liverpool came in for me and I didn't come, Liverpool fans were a bit like, who does he think he is? He should come to Liverpool. We don't want him anymore because he's turned us down and all that kind of stuff. So when I first came to Liverpool, not even the first week, there was a bit of animosity towards me because it had seemed that I'd turned Liverpool down. But I have to say, from the first day in training, when me and Peter had come and then Aldo, like, it just knitted together from the first game against Arsenal. But why that happened, what Liverpool and big clubs did back then is they looked at you over a period of time to see you can fit into what we want. Right. Nowadays, you have a youngster, one good season, costs £50 million, you see his inconsistency.
Yeah.
I've been at Watford for 6 years, playing for England for 4 years. So I've experienced, so I could handle the pressure. Peter Beard's the same thing, England for 4 years, Newcastle for six years.
Yeah.
Whereas that's why I feel sorry for young players now, where all of a sudden you have one good season and someone buys you for £60 million, and then, you know, you go look at Jadon Sancho, for example, whereby he's a fantastic player, but he isn't given time to grow. So that is why, although there was pressure on me coming to Liverpool, Kenny and Rushy had gone, Kenny had retired, me and Peter are now coming, how are we going to replace them? But because we had that experience, and Liverpool saw something in you that you didn't know you had.
Yeah.
Who did I play for? Watford. What type of football is that? Yeah. Completely opposite the way Liverpool play. Yeah. But Liverpool saw that you can do what we want you to do. And that's comes with experience. And I was an experienced player.
What about going into that dressing room, John? Because it was a team full of big characters, big winners. You know, I can imagine it would have been quite daunting.
Well, that is why I would not have liked to have gone as a 17, 18 year old.
Yeah.
They have young boys who come to Liverpool and there's no dressing rooms back then. Yeah. Very, very unforgiving. Yeah. Now, I was an experienced player of 6 years, playing for England for 4 years. So they were my, as much as I'm not playing at a club like that, but I played in the World Cup, I'm an international player. Yeah. So it was easier for me. Yeah. I've seen young players or even players who aren't internationals come to a big club and you know what it's like with the egos and it's like, who do you think you are type of thing.
Yeah.
And ultimately, because as I said, from the first day, it's like at Watford, when I went to Watford as a 17-year-old and the apprentice in the first team, who's this young kid coming in? But what they saw what I could do from the first day, they took to you.
Yeah.
So from the first day in training with me and Peter, it was like we played together all our lives. Played one touch, two touch, whereas at Watford it's all long balls. But, you know, it just worked. And of course, as you know, if football goes well, they forgive you anything, wouldn't they?
Yeah, of course. And the trophies, it's glittering, you know, multiple league titles, FA Cups, the European Cup's not there, but that was at the period when...
We're banned for 5 years.
We're banned.
Liverpool were banned.
Is that something you regret?
Not at all. Because, you know, back then, I mean, now people talk about going to a club. Like, for example, they're talking about Liverpool doing what they're doing now, so Jude Bellingham's not going to come because if they're not in the Champions League. That's ridiculous. Mm. You go to a club because you look at the history, the traditions of the club, the potential that the club actually has to know that.
Yeah.
I still think they finish in the top four, but if they don't, Liverpool or Liverpool. So back then, I knew Liverpool weren't going to be in the European Cup.
Yeah.
Peter Beardsley was the most expensive player in England. He came to Liverpool. We know we're not going to be there, but that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
It's about going to the best club to play the best football, to be able to do as well as you can. So it was about, it wasn't about the prestige of the European Cup. It was about the prestige of the club.
So
therefore, I came to Liverpool, and if they were banned from Europe forever, I still would have gone to Liverpool.
And also, at that time, I would imagine the European Cup didn't hold the same weight as, because... as a league or the FA Cup in that sense?
Well, you know, it did, but it, from a commercial value point of view, not.
Yeah.
Because Liverpool's bread and butter from Bill Shankly's time, first game of the season is, league's the most important thing. Anything else is a bonus. But because of the prestige and the finances now, people talk about, oh, we're going to, like when Liverpool won the European Cup and finished fifth, and it was great. Bill Shankly and people like that, Ronald, would have hated that.
Because
the best team wins the league over 38 games, whatever it is. The best team doesn't win the European Cup. Because you can be lucky. You can play Steaua Bucharest as they did or whoever. And their thing was, we want to be the best. And to be the best, you have to win the league. Because you can be lucky to win the European Cup, which doesn't mean you are the best. So it had a different feeling back then.
You mean you ended up... What was it? Is there any particular moment in your Liverpool career that you want to be remembered? I remember a game at Goodison Park, the 4-4 game where you bent one in the top corner, cup finals, scoring spectacular goals. Is there anything? What encapsulates John Barnes as a footballer? Is there a moment?
My whole career.
Of course, your
No. The good and the bad. Because what makes you are who are a human being is you have to look at what you've actually done.
Yeah.
Because what we can do is what our kids do now with Instagram and Twitter, we want to show our best selves.
Mm.
So now look how great we are, look what we're doing, look what we're doing. But for the other, after the 2 hours, for the other 22 hours, you're feeling miserable and you're feeling horrible, and that's your life, really.
That
whole 2 minutes of you're on Twitter, that's not your life. Your life is when you're having a crappy time and you know whatever you're doing. So I take the good and the bad. So it'd be great if I say, go against Brazil and the league and this and this. But what about the times when I ruptured my Achilles tendon and I wasn't playing well in the crowd? So you look at the average of what you've done and you say, that is who you are. So I've always separated who I am with what I am. And what I was a footballer. Who I am is a normal person, goes to Tesco's, friend, enemy, husband, father, whatever. And I never let them cross over. Because if we as footballers, or if we as celebrities cross over into what we are, being who we are, we would think we're the greatest thing in the world, wouldn't we?
Of course.
Better than what, we wouldn't be talking to people in the street, wouldn't we? Because we are superstars.
Yeah.
So I've never done that. And even in my football career, as much as I can look at individual moments, just to give you an example, this is where I've been brought up in terms of when I won the Player of the Year, 1987-88, my first Player of the Year, PFA Player of the Year, and sports writers, my biggest pleasure, and I'm not just saying this, my biggest pleasure from that was that there were seven Liverpool players in the team of the year. There's seven in the team of the year. The seven that teammates were in that, because as much as an individual award is nice, but what, you know, if I was top scorer and the team finished third and I'm the top scorer, what does that mean? It means nothing, because we're in a team sport. And my dad always talked to me about the responsibility to the team, the family. That's what life is. So to answer your question, there's no individual moment. I can pick out individual moments, but I refuse to do that. I look at my whole career, you know, even when I didn't take the ball in the corner against Arsenal.
We got that written down. But that's a powerful, poignant message, and something, especially for the younger generation
of
social media. You know, it ain't all everyone looking at me.
My kids do it, don't they?
They all do it. They all want to be, you know, look at this and what do
and
I
what,
do?
And the problem that causes other people looking at that think about how terrible their lives are because they're having such a great life. They're having all this great life and look at my life. But if they knew the reality of their lives, when they're not doing that, they'd be doing as miserable as they are. We're all the same. We're all the same.
Yeah, maybe we should start, you know, showing us being stuck in traffic.
Well, exactly. Well, to be honest with you,
I
want to start one. I don't think I'd make much money because my thing would be, I'm starting a part, one of them, I don't even know what they're called, but you know, one of those YouTube things. And my one is mind your own business.
Mate, listen,
mind your own business and get on with your life.
And that's a great message. I mean, you went on to win 5 major trophies with the club, scoring 108 goals and 407 appearances in a 10-year spell. Would you say that Liverpool is the club that you're most synonymous with? I suppose it is.
Yes.
People think John Barnes, they think Liverpool Football Club.
But you know, only because the thing about it is, because of the size of the club. Because I had probably nearly half of my England caps when I was at Watford.
Is that right?
Yeah, I already had like 30-odd caps before I even came to Liverpool. Of course, my career took off, Liverpool, England, blah, blah. The goal against Brazil was at Watford. 1984, I came to Liverpool in 87. And my better career for England was probably when I was at Watford. But because Liverpool is such a big club, that kind of like gets put to the side.
you was at 86 World Cup, 88 Euros, and 1990 is the one that, you know, is very special to me as a young man watching it. What one of them teams do you think was the best England team you played? I mean, I remember you putting a cross in for Gary Lineker to score in 86 in a famous game. But 90 team was the one that...
Yeah, 86 and 90 weren't dissimilar. Gaz obviously came in 1990 and Gary Lineker was still there. 86, yeah. Robbo actually got injured in 1990, so Platy came in. But that 86 and 90 team, but you know, we were never the best team in the world, so we should never have won the World Cup. You know, that's the thing when you talk about England, we should win the World Cup. You look at other teams and there's some good teams around.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So what we should do is be getting to the semi-finals and quarter-finals and stuff. And of course, in 86, no matter what anybody had done, Diego Maradona was incredible.
Yeah.
Nobody could have stopped him.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for the Argentinian team, not unfortunately because they won the World Cup, but a lot of people were very disrespectful to that team, thinking they were a one-man team.
Right.
Burruchaga, Arnauto Kachia, Valdano, they had good players, but Maradona was so much better than everybody else. They were saying, oh, it's all about Maradona. But he was just incredible. I've never seen another player like him, ever. When Italy played Argentina, when did Italy win the World Cup? 1982, Italy won the World Cup. He was man-marked by Gentile, and Gentile fouled him 27 times before he got booked.
That's incredible, isn't it?
27 fouls before he even got booked.
And I bet they weren't...
And they weren't fouled by pulling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's why in 1986, I was just watching in that game. I was on the bench. I'm just watching Maradona. Good thing I had an England shirt on. And I tell you, it took so much power in me for when he scored that goal. Not the handball, the other goal. Yeah. Not to just go. How can you not appreciate that goal?
It was a work of art, weren't it?
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
BT Sport Pods. We can look back in the context of it, and we, from proud Englishmen, we, you know, it hurts, but the actual beauty of the goal.
Yeah.
Was just...
And of course, the handball was a bit... And I'm going to give you another exclusive here about Hodgie. You know Hodgie and the shirt?
Yes.
Do you know the story about Hodgie and the shirt? Do you know? Well, so of course, then Steve Hodge got Maradona's shirt. No one thought about that. No one thought about Maradona. Because, you know, A, we weren't supposed to swap shirts because Bobby Robson, typical, Butch, Peter Shilton, we're not swapping shirts. They're cheating Argentinians. The handball, we're cheating. So we're not swapping shirts.
Yeah.
So we never swapped shirts. We thought we never swapped shirts. Yeah. Never swapped shirts, but we never thought anything about it. Bit like when Luther told me about Graham Taylor. Yeah. Never thought anything about the Maradona shirt. 2002, I'm watching the World Cup, just watching the game against Argentina, and I'm looking at it thinking, oh, I remember that, the game. Because what had happened was as soon as the final whistle went, we've stormed off the pitch.
Yeah.
Thousands of Argentinian fans came on the pitch. Maradona's on their shoulders, they're having the lap of honor. I'm not even thinking about Maradona, but I'm just watching the game. So I'm watching the game thinking, what a great game that was. The game finishes, you see us walk off the pitch.
Yeah.
All the Argentinian fans come on, Maradona's on his top. Just watching anything, oh, look at Maradona, he's that blah, blah, blah. And I've gone on the television. This is 2002. There's Hodgie coming out, walking on the pitch. Thousands of Argentinian fans. Steve Hodge fought his way through all the Argentinian fans. Got his England kit on, he's on the bench. Pulled a Maradona sock. Maradona's looked down. Hodgie's gone, give him his shirt. Maradona's just gone, give him his shirt. I'm like, yeah. Not thinking anything of that. I thought, look at Hodgie, Maradona's shirt. Flipping hell, that's 2002.
Yeah.
When did Maradona die? Last year, the year before last? £7 million later.
I know.
Hodgie, £7 million. But Hodgie didn't get his £7 million because Sotheby's took 20%, so I think he only got 5.5.
That's a racket right there from Sotheby's.
That should have been flipping my shirt. That should have been my shirt.
What foresight that would have from Hodgie. Maybe we should have him in charge of the banks.
Not only that, because he never said anything to anybody. I mean, he never came in. Hodgie's obviously just gone, whoop, came in, put it in his bag.
Unbelievable, sir. Good luck to him. Some good of it for an Englishman, out of it that day.
I know, it's a wrong Englishman, but at least he's an Englishman. Jamaican Englishman could have been them. Should have got that.
So your 1990 World Cup, Gaza. What was that tournament like?
And you know what? And I suppose this really sums, and I spoke to you about responsibility to the team and how the team being the most important thing. That was not a happy World Cup for me because I'd been injured going into it. I was injured all the way through. I played the first four games. I wasn't fit. I shouldn't really have played, but are you going to say you're not fit to play? So it wasn't an injury to stop me playing, but it was carrying an injury.
Yeah.
I'm playing up front, and you've got a lot of running to do, and I was playing within myself because I knew I couldn't extend myself.
Right.
So I wasn't playing well, but we'd gone through.
Yeah.
Then against Belgium, I came off because I got injured, but I was injured throughout, so I shouldn't really have been playing.
Yeah.
But I have to say, when we beat Belgium, and Belgium should have beaten us, they're better than us. When we beat Belgium, I kind of knew that, my World Cup over, I've come off injured. It's a bit of a hamstring. I'm playing again in 5 days, but I'm not really going to say anything. I'll get fit and whatever.
Yeah.
But throughout that period, the feeling of togetherness with the team.
Yeah.
And you know what it's like. If you're on the bench or if you're injured and the team's doing well, do you really want the team to do well and earn your position?
Yeah.
Regardless of what people say, you can't have that feeling, even inside. But even inside, I'm not talking about my outward expression of pretending to be happy. Even inside, I was so happy for that team.
Really?
We got a lot of stick from the press. All throughout the World Cup.
Going into it,
and even throughout the World Cup, there were their stories about what we're doing and stuff like that. Half of them are true, but there you go. But that feeling of togetherness and wanting the team to do well. And then even after Belgium and Platy had scored, and everybody's happy, and I kind of knew my World Cup, well, it wasn't over because I'm not going to tell them, so I'm playing against Cameroon. But I knew I wouldn't be able to do what I could, but I still really wanted the team to do well. Then against Cameroon, I shouldn't even have started. Came off after 20 minutes, 2-1, then we came back. And throughout the whole period after that, even Germany after that, I just felt so happy for the team to be doing well. And as I said at the start, not many people, regardless of what they say, if the team's doing well and everything's happy and you're not playing and you're injured or if you're dropped, you kind of don't want that to happen. But I have to say that that was a feeling where I really felt as a team the most together.
Yeah, I know exactly what you think, because your ego when the team's doing well, when you're not in it, you know, at the end of the day, we warriors and we want to do well for ourselves. So it's tough, but that... The fact that you said that 1990 World Cup, it sparked, not only did it spark the interest of football in me, I think it sort of reignited football. The Premier League got involved and we realised what it could do.
It didn't reignite it, it started it.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't that feeling. There wasn't this whole celebrity mentality around football back then. You know, from it started up until 1990, footballers, you go to the pub with your mates and blah, 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 and they love you, but you weren't treated as celebrities. Whereas after that, particularly after Gazamania started and the Premier League started a couple of years after. That is when this whole celebrity thing now, we're footballers.
Yeah.
And of course, we've come so far the other way now, where footballers don't mix with the public, they don't sign autographs, they don't just walk out into the street.
Yeah.
But that's when it really started after 1990.
You mentioned him there, Gaza, like, you know, incredible. In the week, mental health, we're filming this in mental health week, and he's clearly had a lot of problems, Gaza. And
Gaza's troubled. Gaza has been troubled.
Did you see that as a young man, or was he just...
Oh, no. We knew Gaza, no.
Really?
But we understood, because I knew that, if you know the history of Gaza, Gaza's been...
I read his book,
like that since he's been at 8 and 9 and 10. It's not, he's a footballer, drugs, alcohol, whatever he's doing, then he, you know, because he's had issues from he was young. And that's just continued. And this is bigger than football.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with football.
Yeah.
Because if Gaza wasn't a footballer, he would be like lots of other people who are like that. And that is what people have to understand. It's not because of football that Gaza is like that. It's not because of what football did to him or he did in the football. This is an issue which is bigger than football.
Yeah.
So while football can highlight it, the best thing football can do is say it is not a football problem.
Mm.
It is a society problem, just like racism or sexism or homophobia, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're trying to then say that football can, you know, look at footballers, and because then people then look at footballers or rugby players are going through a similar thing.
Yeah.
And all we're doing then is concentrating on the footballers, feeling empathy and sympathy, or the rugby players, or the actors. And we're neglecting the average person in the street.
Yeah.
And this is who we should be talking about. So this should be used from a mental health perspective, racism, sexism, whatever, to highlight the problems in society, not highlight the problems in those privileged industries.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people feel sorry for footballers, and it's, you know, just because they're footballers, they have mental health problems. other people who are neglected are the ones who probably need it even more. So what it can do is highlight the issue, and Gaza is typical of that, of highlighting the issue of mental health. But let us get away from it just in the higher echelons of society and think about what goes on down below. And the biggest problem with that is that a lot of people then show so much sympathy and support for the superstars. We feel sorry for guys, we feel sorry for actors, and we feel sorry for them. But no one talks about how terrible it is for people.
Whilst walking down the road and there's a homeless person who's...
And who really cares about him?
Yeah, it's right. Football can shed a light on things, but it can't fix the ills of the world.
Can't That's got to be a solution. Yeah.
You know, and again, we're going a bit off on a tangent. Again, people sort of put football and people in the game up to pedestals to be these... When really it's the people in charge of the big business, the big economics and that, who can actually make the systemic change.
Absolutely.
And actually make a difference. Not Gaza or Marcus Rashford or what I mean? Someone like... Yeah. It needs to be these people.
That's what has to happen. What has to happen. But unfortunately, we're not doing that.
But yes, very much so. But we need to touch a little bit on Newcastle time and when you went there. What a team. I'm reading the names. Rush, Barnes, Shearer. Gary
well,
Rush Speed.
And Barnes were in their 30s, so you can talk about Shearer and Gary Speed. It was a good team. Yeah. It was a good team. I'd gone there at 33. Rush was like 35 or 36. Mm. Well, they were in the Champions League.
Yeah.
You know, Liverpool weren't. We finished fifth. Newcastle finished. We went there. When they're in the Champions, that's the only time I played in the Champions League for Newcastle.
Incredible.
Yeah, we beat Barcelona 3-2.
Yeah, I remember the game.
We beat Barcelona 3-2. But once again, that is a situation whereby expectations were different. I remember for Newcastle just to be in the Champions League was great. Mm. And the fans were fantastic because they hadn't had success. I mean, they got Shearer and Asprilla was there and stuff like that. And this was the period. Kenny had come after Kevin Keegan had left.
Yes.
And Kenny is a completely different manager to Kevin. Kenny's completely different. Kenny was more pragmatic, and Kenny knows the pressures of having to win football matches, whereas Kevin as a manager wants to play great football.
And Newcastle
love that. Yeah. So you remember the time when, I love it if with Man United, when Man United won the league, Newcastle fans love that because, of course, it's about the way we play without having the pressure to win.
Yeah.
But when Kenny went there, he tried to change it to say, forget about how good football you want to play. And of course, because it's fighting against that, because they didn't want that, because Kevin Keegan played a different type of football, so it didn't work. Great place to play, though. The fans were fantastic. Lovely city, great part of the world. Mm. Fans were, and really, I just wanted to be successful more than for them, because they're so loyal. Yeah. So I had a great time up in Newcastle.
Yeah, exciting times. And then you finished your career at Charlton, and this is where we crossed over. We had this off-air discussion. I remember it vividly, but you, as a 16-year-old, I was on the bench at West Ham. You was at Charlton, and we had Razor playing for us. I don't know if sometimes your memory plays tricks on you, but I just remember Carl Tyler and Razor going at it and a punch up in the tunnel afterwards, and you in the middle of it breaking up, me somehow getting in the middle of it as a 10-stone, dripping wet 16-year-old. And I remember just looking at you thinking, wow, there's John Barnes. I'm actually doing this.
I'm about to knock him out. The thing about it, Joe, is that what you have to remember is that football back then, well, not so much back then because it was 99, but even before that, because I've been playing obviously since 1980, this was happening all the time.
Yeah.
You know, fighting in the tunnel, fighting in the dressing room, fighting on the pitch. Mm. So for a 16-year-old boy, you'd never seen it before. This is like, how is this happening type of thing?
I mean, I've seen it, but not with the finest rapper England's ever produced.
Well,
in
there you go.
But of course,
every now and again in Somerstown, you know, you're going to get stuck in. But the thing about it is that this would happen. I mean, there are times when you go into the opposition's dressing room.
Yeah.
I remember once I said about a Birmingham, you go into the dressing room and be fighting in the dressing room, forget the tunnel. In the tunnel, it was always something. So, that was, and of course, if Razor's involved and Carl Tyler, the big lad, and Fraser's involved, there's going to be trouble. But, you know, once again, things that happen now, and people go, can you believe, I speak to people now, and they go, looking at tackles in the past, or anything in the past, or even players going out until 5 in the morning, doing what they're doing, with no mobile phones.
Yeah.
And people go, can you believe that this was happening?
Yeah.
That's the way it was.
Yeah.
I'm sure you had.
Yeah.
I'm sure you got a dig in, Joe, didn't you?
My specialty, kick and run. But
the interesting thing about what you just mentioned about Newcastle and Charlton, I wanted to play football. A lot of players now want to finish at the top. You're playing for Man United, you're going to retire, 33, 34, whatever it is. My thing was I love football more than I love Liverpool, Watford, anybody. I love football.
Yeah.
So if it means that I can't play for Liverpool anymore because I'm 35, 36, I'm willing to go and play somewhere else.
Yeah.
Lesser. And if it means that Newcastle, I'm going to go to Charlton, then I have to go to Tranmere because I love football, that's what I'm going to do. So my ego isn't such that I want to finish at the top. So if I can't play for Liverpool anymore, I'm not going to play for anybody else. So I'm not. Newcastle was different because obviously Newcastle were in the Champions League. But even after that, when Rudd came, did he ever go to Chelsea?
No.
And I wasn't going to be playing at Newcastle. I went to Charlton. And to be fair, if Keddie hadn't come in for me to be managing Celtic, I would have gone and played lower down for somebody else.
Yeah. Well, same with me, Matt. I finished in America. I loved it. I would, and the only reason I stopped playing was family reason. The family wanted to come back from America. Yeah. Otherwise, I'd probably still be playing because I could probably still play at that level. But that takes in, seemed like you managed Celtic. You know, you brought in Kenny was the director of football, massive club. Would you have done anything differently in your managerial thing? Would you have started at a different level? What a club to go into.
Listen, and this is how I knew I was going to be under a lot of pressure. Sheffield United kind of like had a word with me about being the manager. And then Kenny came in, and I was thinking, I hope Sheffield United come back.
Really?
I would have gone to Sheffield United, because I knew that, A, I wouldn't be accepted at Celtic because of many different reasons. I'm not from Scotland, blah, 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 and, you know, what have I done, X, Y, Z. As strange as it seems, I went to Celtic because I never had another option. Mm. You know, normally, you go to manage a lower division team because you haven't got an option higher up. With me, I had to go there because I couldn't go anywhere else, because I knew that when I'm at Celtic, if everything goes well, but I said, if we lose a couple of games, I'm going to be in trouble. Yeah. End of story. Now, it's interesting because, of course, we won the first out of it, 13 games. We won 11, drew one, lost one to Rangers, four points behind Rangers. And all through that period, I was getting hammered. We scored more goals than Rangers, who were a very attacking team. A.L. Berkovic, you know, if you play with A.L. Henry Clark, so we were playing really well.
Yeah.
But we lost to Rangers. And throughout that period, of being 4 points behind Rangers, won 11 games, I was getting abused from the press. I don't know what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. So I said to myself, if this is what it's like when we're doing okay, if we go through a sticky patch. So I said to my missus, I said, don't bother moving up. I said, I'm not going to be here for long. Because when Larson broke his leg, Lambert broke his jaw, I knew then we wouldn't be able to compete with Rangers. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing about it is how people have a perception of what success is. Now, we lost to Inverness in the Cup, who were in the division below us, by the way. Yeah. So we should never have lost them, but we did. So, of course, it's a disaster, my time at Celtic. I just asked somebody there, if you're listening to me, about Google. Google's fantastic. Steven Gerrard did really well at Rangers.
Yeah.
And now we've also come down to Aston Villa. I have got a better win percentage than Steven Gerrard at Rangers.
Really?
If you Google John Barnes' win percentage at Celtic, 65%. Steven Gerrard's is 64.9.
Wow.
But because we lost to Inverness County Thistle, that was a disaster. His time at Celtic was a disaster. Mm-hmm. And one manager of the month in January, February the 4th, we lost to Inverness County Thistle and I was sacked. So when people give a perception of what it is, the reality is that if you just look at the football, in terms of the wins that we actually had and the win percentages, is not as people are making it out to be. But there was an agenda because I wasn't affiliated with Celtic. I am a Catholic, but I didn't say I'm a Catholic, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I wasn't affiliated with Celtic.
You didn't play the game?
Or I didn't. And also, Kenny wasn't particularly popular there as well with the press and stuff like that. So from my first... And I was on the mind. The press were always on the mind. He's a yes man. Yeah, he's not really in charge. And once players see that, and they believe that you're not in charge, and a lot of it had to do with the money.
Yeah.
Because the Celtic players, their contracts weren't great. A lot of them were on £3,000-£4,000 a week. What were Rangers paying? £20,000 a week. Bronkhurst, Michael Moles, Loudrop. And that's why Rangers got into trouble. They are. Why they went bankrupt. Yeah, because they were paying money. So of course, Celtic players were like, all of a sudden, we're like them. Why aren't we getting paid? So therefore, they then wanted those contracts, but they were on 2 and 3 and 4 year contracts on not much money. Now, I said, and I've got to handle that, because the players aren't happy. Yeah. Celtic started to do well, first 11 games, and of course, you knew me and Kenny have come, so why would we need new contracts? And the club weren't giving them new contracts. So they weren't happy financially. Of course, when Martin O'Neill came, then they signed Chris Sutton, and they started to pay the players £20,000 a week, so everything was happier. So but my thing was I wanted to manage, and I still want to manage, and I felt I could have done a good job, but you have to be given time. And I knew from the first 6 weeks, if everything went well and we won all the games, it would have been fine. Mm. But I knew if I went through a sticky patch of losing a few matches as you can, that I wouldn't last.
I mean, you said that you still want to manage. Is that something you would do if the right opportunity came?
Well, the right opportunity isn't going to come, is it? The wrong opportunity will come. The club I'm going to get is going to be a club that haven't got much money, haven't got great players, but their expectations, because John Barnes is there now, is going to be like, well, why aren't you doing something? So it's a question as to whether I will take the wrong opportunity, because the right opportunity is not going to come along. So, you know, I still think I would like to do it, and I still think I would do it under the right circumstances, not meaning the right club, but meaning, A, I have to be able to afford to do it. Because what I'm doing now and my lifestyle now, and of course when you've got 7 kids and stuff like that, you've got a lot of money to pay out.
Yeah.
Whereas if you become a football manager, you have to give all that up. And the club that I will be going to will not going to be paying me a lot of money. So it's a question of whether I'm able to do that.
Like circumstances. I mean, talking to Glenn Hoddle, who I work with at BT Sport, and I constantly pick his brains about coaching and management because it's something I would want to do at some point. And he actually says, at his age now, he says he's not going to do it now because, like, similar situation to yourself, he's happy doing the media. And
but the difference is Glenn has done it. He's managed England, he's managed Tottenham, he's managed this, where I haven't. So I still feel I have unfinished business. Glenn hasn't got unfinished business. Yeah. He's managed England and done everything, hasn't he?
He said, though, Barnsley, he said he thinks now, at his age, he said he's actually better equipped than what he was when he was managing England, he said, in terms of his, like, wisdom and how he
sees
the
way
world.
He will then manage now as opposed to the way he managed back then.
Oh, mate, if there's, I just think someone of your calibre and Glenn's, it's a travesty to not be. I tell Glenn all the time, I think it's a travesty not to be involved in football at the highest echelon.
I spoke about Glenn's ability as a player, but even when we played, I'm 21, 19, playing for England, and he's playing, and there's Brian Robson and Peter, so we're all there. Yeah. And of course, when you watch him play football, and you see what a great player he was, and you think what a great player he is. And because of the way he was, you think, it's not going to be a manager, coach, because he's just a natural footballer. He plays off the cuff like Gatti, he's a great player. Back then, you speak to him about football.
Yeah.
His knowledge and understanding about tactics, about, you know, formations, systems, the way players have to play. He was so far ahead of his time.
Yeah.
He was just, as a coach, he would be incredible in terms of his ideas that he actually has as well.
Yeah, and still the same now in the studio. Yeah. You know,
his knowledge is incredible.
If there's anything, something we're a little bit unsure of, it's like, Glenn, what are we thinking? And he'll just do that.
Yeah. He'll pick up something whereby you're looking at it and he's sure it's instead of playing the wrong position or what he should be doing. He's just so knowledgeable.
Yeah, and I mean, you've Tranmere and Jamaica, polar opposites. Like I said, you've taken some eclectic jobs.
The only ones that I got offered. Not by choice. And the Jamaican one was interesting, and I love the Jamaica job because my thing, I suppose this comes from Graham Taylor, when Watford came from the fourth division to the top division, is that to be a professional footballer, you've got to be a good player.
Yeah.
Even the third, fourth division.
Yes.
Because I see my son, who's now a banker, he was a fantastic footballer. He's not even good enough to play fourth division.
Yeah.
So you can't be a League Two player and not be a good footballer.
Yeah.
But of course, it's like, oh, you can't play football down there because you're not a... And I'm looking at non-league players who are very good, and I think you've got to be better than that. So you have to be a good player to be a professional footballer. Yeah. That's the first thing. If you can then get the right organisation and right physical ability and be even average players, you can maximise the potential of that team. Mm. Now, with Jamaica, they're skillful, they're quick. Mm. You organise them and you give them discipline. They can compete. So with Jamaica, we never lost one game. Never lost one game.
We played against
Mexico, El Salvador, teams who were better than us. Nigeria, we played them here in London, and we were like 19 in the world. And because I said we're going to be organised, and they're strong and physical.
Yeah.
So if you organise them, not that we were going to beat teams. So we drew a lot of we drew 4 games, 1-8, but we would compete in all the games. Give them organisation. I think even when you go down to lower leagues, if you can organise your team and get good players and have a system that the players understand, rather than saying just go out and play. Which is what everyone says, go and express yourself. Because people don't understand that. People think that Man City players go and express themselves. They express themselves within the framework of the team.
Yeah.
Which is why when people say, let Jack Grealish go and express himself, he's not. He's got to play in that position and do the right thing.
Yeah.
And everybody has to do that. Liverpool, Arsenal, they all do that. But they just think that when you've got good players, just go out and play yourself. Mm. You know, people look at you and they didn't understand what a disciplined player you were, as much as they see you dribbling. They didn't understand when you're playing that left side role for England in a diamond or whatever, you have a requirement, you've got a responsibility that you have to do for the team. But people don't see that. They just think, oh, you just go and play.
Yeah, no. They got the luxury of looking at it like a fan.
Yeah.
Right, you know, in the game, you've got to look at it very pragmatically.
Absolutely.
But listen, it sounds to me like, no, that there's a little bit of something inside you that I think you're going to end up doing it.
Well, I hope I'm in my way, but unfortunately, there are other circumstances that need to, other stars have to align, and I don't know if we're ready for them yet.
Quick fire round. Right, here we go. Remember, these are none of my questions, they're the guys. Questions, you know what I mean?
Right,
so there's some dodgy ones, I'm already throwing them under the bus. If you could go back and relive any moment from your career, what would it be and why?
Wimbledon Cup final. A lot of people think it would be the Arsenal game, take the ball in the corner. But you know, over 38 games, it's not just that, why we lost the league. That's an individual moment, but you're all the moment. But that Wimbledon Cup final, I mean, we scored a goal, we were the better team, we missed the penalty, blah, blah, blah. But I think that that's just a time when we never played well. That year, we should have done the double.
Iconic game. Who's the best teammate you've ever had?
The best teammate I've ever had from a footballing perspective is Peter Beardsley. Yes. With England and Liverpool, he's a selfless player, play for the team. Not great on a night out, doesn't drink and stuff like that. So he's not my teammate in that respect.
He likes his sweets, doesn't he?
He likes his sweets, yeah, and his chocolate, yeah. And he drives because he doesn't drink, so he's the best teammate.
Great teammate.
Great teammate. Peter's driving and bringing chocolate.
If you could go back and change any moment of career, what would it be?
I would not change anything because, of course, once again, you can take the rough with the smooth. Because I can change lots of stuff to then be great and be brilliant and be perfect, but that's not reality, so I wouldn't change anything.
Beautiful answer.
Apart from, obviously, getting Maradona's shirt.
Yes, definitely that. Steve Hodge, what a man. Who's the toughest defender you played against?
Most difficult was Viv Anderson, not because he was necessarily good defensively, because he was attacking all the time.
Right.
And my first responsibility, as always, Graham Taylor said it, you don't let the fullback get the running.
Yeah.
You know when foreign players came and it's like, I'm not chasing you, but I had to do that.
Yeah.
But the toughest, I was very fortunate playing on the left because the Lunatics were all left backs, so the right wingers. So you got like Mark Dennis, Julian Dix, you know, Stuart Pearce, they want to kick you. But the right backs were okay. Yeah. That's probably why you played on the left as well, you're right footed.
I fleeted.
No, you stayed on the left most of the time, mate. I'm telling you, you didn't like those Lunatic left backs. Tony was quite difficult, Tony Adams. The new Tony Adams, not the one pre-Wenger.
Yeah,
pre-Wenger. Tony was easy to play against.
You know? It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, as always.
As always, mate.
And we didn't even talk about the wrap.
BT Sport Pods.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. Once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists assign a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.